Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. We own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you today?
Chipper.
We want to talk about gadgets.
There are a lot of wine gadgets out there. Every magazine, everything that's connected to the Wine Spectator, the Wine Enthusiast will send you a little catalog, IWA. There's all these little catalogs, and they all want to sell gadgets.
Okay, here are some gadgets we don't recommend. First of all, the idea, if you don't have a place in your house where there's a consistent temperature, preferably below 60 degrees, and you have some wine you want to invest in, you want to buy a wine cooler for home.
I want to just travel backwards for a second. We do use those catalogs, and we do buy some things from both of those companies.
Wine Enthusiast is a good company. Mm-hmm. I like them a lot. Mm-hmm. But there's stuff that makes sense, and there's stuff that doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
And no reason to... If you have a place in your cellar where it's dark, it's vibration-free, keep it away from the washing machine, mm-hmm. and the temperature is a constant temperature, and anywhere between 55 and 65, I think, is fine, you're probably okay. But if you don't have that, and I don't... You want to buy a wine cooler.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mark has...
next to the hot water heater, isn't it?
Mark,
that's not your answer.
Mark has a wine cooler.
Mm-hmm.
I have, because I use... In Jersey City, I have a basement, but the basement fluctuates in temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to buy a special unit, because most of these units are meant to be kept in your house and only have cooling.
Right.
Mine is in the basement, and it's not low
basement
enough.
Basement could get hot, basement could get cold.
So I have a unit that both heats and cools. There are very few units that do both of those things. If you need heating and cooling, as I do in Jersey City, you need to be sure you have a unit that does both of those things, mm-hmm. and my wine is kept at a perfect 55 degrees.
There's also something that's really become popular lately, and I just want to warn people against it. It's the two different temperature zones in the condensing unit. Inside the unit, there'll be a cold zone and then a regular red zone. And what they're called sometimes is a white zone and a red zone. What you want to be careful about that is, generally we keep these items in these units because we're looking to age them. We're looking to have them for some time. Once you put something in that cold zone, you potentially can do damage to your wine.
Or you'll slow down the aging. The idea is, you chill a bottle of champagne when it comes time to drink it.
Right.
And frankly, if it's in your cellar at 55 degrees or 60 degrees, when you want to chill it, it's only going to take a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't store champagne. You don't age champagne at 37 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. We're a restaurant, and what you'll see is we have what we call our white room, and those are the wines that are actively in use. But then you'll see on the shelves of our restaurant inside our wine cellar and both our wine library, and we have three different wine rooms in addition to the cold room that we use. You'll see white wines on the shelves there.
They're just aging.
Those white wines we intend on having for a while, and we're aging them. The wines that are in the cooler are wines that are meant to be sold relatively quickly.
So when you're buying a wine cellar at home, and we've gotten a lot of emails asking us to give advice about that, and look, we listen to your emails. And we do show. Some of the things that I think are sort of, there are two things about these. One, if it's going to be in your living room, buy the nice door and the mm-hmm. pen that can make a nice piece of furniture. My stuff in my basement in Jersey City, okay, where I have to, like, go out of my apartment, go down three floors, like, open up the gunmetal door and then go into the cage in my basement. Yeah, they're just black boxes, okay? They're black boxes, but they do have a lock on them because I am in Jersey City. Now, some of the accoutrements or the accessories that they'll try and sell you, are one of them that really makes no sense at all is there's an internal wine sensor thermometer. Mm-hmm. And the way it works is that you want to know, they bill it as you want to know exactly the temperature of the wine itself.
Of the liquid.
Knowing the air, what the temperature of the air is inside the box isn't good enough. So it's this little probe. And you basically take a wine bottle, fill it with water, put the probe in your cell, in the cabinet, and that way you'll have a reading. The wire comes to the outside and lets you know exactly what the temperature of the liquid is. Why do you care?
Right. You want to change the air temperature before the liquid temperature changes anyway.
Right, exactly. So it's there's no reason to know that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that if the temperature of the air is 55 degrees and hasn't changed, the temperature of the wine is going to be 55 degrees.
So that's one of the gadgets we advise against. One of the gadgets we advise for, a lot of these units will come with a low vibration option. If you have an opportunity to get one with a low vibration option, that's a really good idea. Vibration is the enemy of wine.
Part of the process of aging wine is wine as it ages. Wine aging is basically a controlled process of decay, right? And so as wine ages, in its process of decay, as all things tend toward entropy, there are little back eddies of complex molecules that form. And those, the aging of wine is the in a good way, the élevage of wine is when we get some simple molecules that, as the wine ages, they link up and make longer chains. And these long, large molecules account for a lot of the complexity of aging mm-hmm. wine. If you're vibrating wine, these molecules won't form.
You hinder those chains from linking up and becoming those long, complex molecules.
Next topic of gadgetry, we had... A gentleman come in.
Very, very nice gentleman.
Very nice gentleman. Came in, and he has one of these things. I've seen them. They're called Clé de Vin, wine keys, right?
They're like $100 in the magazines.
And the Clé de Vin, I like saying that, Clé de Vin. but the wine key, it's a little piece of copper and some other metal alloy, and the idea is that you take this little piece of copper
and you put it in the wine, and it will reduce the tannins. The tannins are the things...
No, well, that's not how they bill it.
Well, it'll age your wine, but...
Right. Let's deal with
that.
Go ahead. You put the Clé de Vin in your glass of wine, which looks really silly at a bar.
And the marketing is every second it's in the wine will age your wine 1 year.
The most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Okay. Because one of the things that happens as wine ages is tannins get softer. That's mm-hmm. one of the things. That's the least important thing that...
Well, it's one of the things that's interesting and that people look for in an older wine.
But
you look for softer, more complex tannins. One of the things that we're talking about is, you know, those tannin molecules linking up.
But you look for softer and more complex.
That was the key phrase that I just used.
And, go ahead, you want to tell the story?
So, we put this little, you know, we experimented
with it. The guy does a demonstration.
We experimented with it. He put in, and we took the same glass of wine, and we put the
Clé de Vin.
The Clé de Vin in the wine, in the vin. And we did it for 15 seconds, because we really wanted to do a real experiment.
So according to the marketing, that should have aged this glass of Cabernet 15 years.
15 years.
Your impression?
My impression, well, let me be straight, okay? First thing.
Your wife will be pleased.
Did the wine change in the glass?
Yes.
Absolutely, that the metal alloy in this Clé de Vin changed the wine in the glass. Next, probably more important question: did it make it better?
No. No. Now you funny too. No. here's the deal. Yes, it softened the tannins, but that's not the point.
Right.
Aging wine, we haven't figured out how to do it yet, and there is no magic buzzer that you can stick in your wine. And you know what? I'm
not even going to say that this particular device wouldn't make some wines better, because it might make some wines better that are over the top with
but these
with
people are charlatans.
Tannins.
These people are charlatans, and they're taking advantage of people who haven't had a lot of experience, and most Americans haven't had a lot of experience mm-hmm. with aged wines, and it's really hard, and you got to be patient. If you want to age some wines at home, I have a suggestion on how to do it. Buy them and then don't drink them for a long time.
Or spend a lot of money and buy some old ones.
Seriously,
with these items, just you know, be careful with them. Just because something changes doesn't mean that it's changed for the better.
And if you want to age some wines, and I recommend it, you can email us at francis@restaurantguysradio.com or mark@restaurantguysradio.com, and I'll make some suggestions to wines that age well, because not all wines age well, and most don't. But there are some inexpensive ones, like German whites. You'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. $10-$15, and they can age for like 20 years. Stick them in your cellar and go back every year or two and try one, and you'll be amazed. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in lovely downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today we're talking with Cornell Professor Stephen L. Kaplan, who is one of the foremost, the preeminent French bread scholar in the world. He joins us from his home in Paris.
Stephen, welcome to the show.
Should I say bonjour?
Bonjour!
Hi there.
How are
now,
you?
I have to clear this up for a lot of our listeners, because the gentleman who comes on WCTC after us is also named Steve Kaplan. You are not the same guy.
Unless he's from Brooklyn and played three sewer stickball, he's not the same guy.
He may have, but he's still not the same guy. Now, you are a French bread scholar. You're one of the foremost experts in the world on French bread. And you're not a baker. You're a scholar of French bread.
I'm not a baker, though I was trained in the school of the Grand Moulin de Paris, which is a big mill, many years ago, as a baker. And I did that, I say parenthetically, because I knew I could not write convincingly about bread unless I plunged my hands in it. So it's fair to say that I have basic baker training.
Sometimes you got to spill a little flour, as it were.
You do indeed.
Let me contextualize this for everybody. Your book, The Bakers of Paris and the Bread Question, 1700 to 1775, is an award-winning 750-page examination of, and I'm reading here from some release somewhere, I don't know what, of power, that my research assistant gave me, of the power and symbolism of bread in the 18th century France. It's an amazing book, and you've also been dubbed the Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. You've been given the Legion of Honor in France twice for you and Americans' work on bread. What's wrong with you? Why don't you tell us what the story of bread is?
Well,
I didn't realize there was such a story to bread.
There are two stories. There's the generic story of bread, and there's the story of Steve meets bread. And the two obviously are not of the same global significance. The story of bread is a story of a product which happens to be located at the point of intersection between the material and the symbolic. That is to say, bread in much of Europe and in many other places in the world has always been, until quite recently, the source of survival, the ration of survival for the vast majority of the population. At the same time, it had an extraordinary sacred dimension. That's the symbolic side, for Christians, for example, embodying quite literally Christ. So this powerful combination of bread as the staff of life, the promise of salvation, and at the same time the constant reminder of misery, since bread was almost always in short supply and threatened. This makes of bread, in some profound way, the framing story of the human experience until quite recently, at least in European / Atlantic civilization. So it's intrinsically extraordinarily important. And in my case, when I was a grad student, I was looking for, in the hubris particular to graduate students, I was looking for something that sort of touched all aspects of the human experience. I wanted to do something in the French historical tradition that was a kind of total metaphor that. And I thought about wine, the blood rather than the body, and wine had already been done. I thought about love, I thought about death, I thought about lots of things which are powerfully mobilizing. And then I came across bread, which struck me as being extraordinarily interesting, and after examination, much to my astonishment, I discovered that it really hadn't ever been studied before, seriously, probably because it's taken for granted. It's such a banal, everyday thing, and I found myself looking at a huge, huge historical problem, because when you look at bread, you need to look at flour. When you look at flour, you look at mills. When you look at mills, you need to look at grain production, and you find yourself in a whole spiral where you move from the technological to the spiritual, from the political to the social, from the cultural to the linguistic. So bread became a kind of lifelong preoccupation. I've written 12, 13 books about various aspects of what I would call the bread nexus. And I swear I haven't repeated myself in the 14 books over and over again.
You know, it's amazing. And one of the things we talk about, and we've had people talk about the philosophies of food and the basic building blocks of food. And you may have heard other guests on the show, we talk about milk and honey are the two natural products. They're the only two things that are created as food with no other purpose than to be food.
Yeah.
And then from that, you have bread. And the three most symbolic foods that, from a number of folks we've talked to, have always been milk and honey and then bread. And it's the basic stuff of life. Now, your specialty is talking about bread in France and in Europe. Have you looked at bread in other parts of the world as well?
I have. I mean, if you look to Mexico, if you look to Egypt, if you look to Iraq, if we can that geographical expression anymore without trembling. If you look in many other places in the world, even there are certain parts of China, for that matter. There are certain parts of Asia. There's post-war Japan, which was Americanized and indeed Frenchified. You find bread in many civilizations, and in many civilizations deeply anchored at the same intersection between symbolic and material concerns. So bread, though I've looked at it in the French and European context simply because it's my specialty, and it's impossible, given the kind of detail that I need to master, for me to do this thing every place. If you look elsewhere, you find very similar structural situations where you find a great dependence of a vast majority of the population on bread, and we move in the same direction. We move from a long-term dependence which is conflictual, which is precarious, which insists upon vulnerability, and we move gradually into a place where we move from a bread that's made of secondary grains to a bread that's made of wheat. Wheat was, of course, the body of Christ in most forms of communion.
We're going to leave it with the body of Christ for just a moment.
Yep.
We'll be back talking more in just a moment with Professor Steve Kaplan, the world's preeminent scholar on bread. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater, starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally, she's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn, and on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, an evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or CatherineLombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Cornell Professor Stephen L. Kaplan, who is the world's preeminent scholar on bread. We were talking before the break about bread in society and bread as the body of Christ. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Steve, was culture to culture in Europe. I know that in some places bread was made communally by communal bakers, and sometimes the bread bakers were, you know, they were like a public utility. Do the different cultures of Europe treat bread very differently, or have they politically in the past?
No. Bread is above all something powerfully political, because almost invariably it's the source of the legitimation of whatever government's in power, and it's the object of extraordinarily intrusive and indeed obsessive regulation.
And it's the food supply of a lot of the cultures throughout history.
Exactly, and it's why in the French case, for example, the king is emblematically considered to be the baker of last resort, and he was literally called le boulanger, the baker, for a long time. So it's, again, it's very, very similar in most societies, because most societies begin as societies of penury and only gradually move into a world of relative abundance. So whereas yesterday bread was a matter of necessity, today it's a matter of hedonism. Today we can talk about bread with a kind of jolly, cavorting desire to find the best bread, and that's what interests me. I relish bread. It impassions me, and I think about bread in terms of pleasure. But until quite recently, bread was incidentally a matter of pleasure, but it was primordially a matter of life and death.
I'll be honest with you, it was the pleasure aspect that made us want you to come on the show.
Yeah, but I mean, so
I don't blame you. I mean, but you know, I mean, the two are linked, because they really bespeak a tremendous mutation in the human experience, and since we're liberated from necessity, except on the margins, thank goodness, and the margins remain important, but still, we can talk about bread as pleasure, whereas in the middle of the 18th century, in most places in Europe, it was hard to do that.
Yeah, well, and the thing is that, you know, the armies marched on bread and a war would be fought over whether you had bread or not. You
Absolutely.
Know? Our guest is Stephen Kaplan. He is the world's preeminent scholar on bread. He's a professor at Cornell University. And after the news, we're going to talk more with him about actual the breads that are being baked today, some judgings he does in New York. It's not just a historical and intellectual thing. I mean, nobody knows bread like Stephen Kaplan. And we're going to tell you where to find great bread around here and in New York after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Stephen Kaplan. Stephen is a professor at Cornell University. He is the world's preeminent scholar on bread. He has been twice given the named a Knight of the Legion of Honor, the Chevalier of the Legion of Honor in France for his work. And we've been talking in the first part of the show about bread and history. Let's talk about bread in contemporary society. Yeah. You're not just an expert on the role it plays has played in
no
history.
No pun intended.
Sorry about that. But you also talk about what makes great bread today. And a lot of people, you know, you're the authority on that as well. What makes great bread great?
Well, I think the crucial thing to think about when one thinks about bread is conviviality and sensuality, and I think that bread is an object of communion, not only in the spiritual sense but in the social sense, and breaking bread together creates extraordinary bonds. So that's the sort of social context in which I think about bread, and we want when we think about bread to represent bread in terms of its organoleptic or sensorial qualities. That is to say, bread solicits all of our senses. It talks to our sense of taste, obviously, to our sense of smell. It's very tactile. We eat it with our fingers. We also feel it in our mouth and in our jaw. It makes noise. It sings to us. It appeals thus to our hearing. And of course, it also is a matter of our sight and our appreciation for the way it looks. So it has these sensual or sensorial qualities. And when we assess bread, we want to look at all of those qualities, keeping in mind above all that bread is born of a living thing. Bread is born of four elements that are as elemental as one can imagine. It is flour, it is water, it is very little salt, less and less, and it is an agent of fermentation. That agent of fermentation is alive, and it's tens of millions, even billions of microorganisms, which give to bread its capacity to rise. And the fact that it's living substance makes it very hard for us to reproduce every day the same exact quality, the same exact aspect. And that's what makes bread interesting, as long as we remain in an artisanal context. Obviously, if we talk industrial bread, it's going to be replicated almost exactly every day. And that's the kind of bread I think is much less interesting, mm-hmm. even though I think it's democratized access to bread, and I'm not going to dump on it in those terms. But if we talk about quality, we're talking about artisanal manufacture of bread, manufacture making by one's hands. We're talking about baking bread from A to Z. We're talking about kneading, about fermenting, about fashioning.
Well, and one of the things you just alluded to the fact that bread is alive and that it's going to be different every single day. And there are so many factors that make it different. And whether it's the baker's hands, or whether it's the water that you're using, or the flour, or the day, if it's humid, or the weather outside.
Exactly.
People may not realize this. And in Europe, it's very common. I remember the first time I went to Europe, I was in Spain, and I was there for about 5 months. And I was almost surprised to learn as a young man that there are two kinds of bakeries, and there are two different words for them in Spanish. One is a panadería, which is the bread bakery, and the other is a postería, which is the dessert bakery.
Right.
And in so many countries in Europe, there's, you know, the bread baker just bakes bread. Because it is a living thing, and it's very difficult to manage, and you need to take care of a lot more factors than with almost any other thing.
It's very hard to master, and indeed the complexity of bread is reflected in an interesting way in its aromatic composition. It's composed of many more volatile substances than wine, for example. So it's a much more challenging food or item to taste because it has this extraordinary palette of different tastes and aromas.
Let's talk about when you go and you open a piece of bread and you're judging a piece of bread. How do you do it, and what do you look for that makes that you judge to be a
All
quality
right, well,
bread?
Let's frame our conversation in a way that makes the discussion comparable. Let's only talk for the moment about baguettes. Instead of talking about apples and oranges, let's stay within the same field. What I do when I approach a baguette, first of all, is I look at it. I want to assess its architecture. I want to look at its appearance. I don't want to judge it simply on the basis of its externalities, but I expect it to be seductive. I don't want it to have pustules. I want it to come from a refractory floor, so I want to look at its back. I don't want it to be, as the French say, baisé, which is to say uncooked on the side. I want it to be a golden brown, pulling towards an orange. I want it to give me a kind of spectacle even as I look at it. Then I want to take my bread knife and I want to section it vertically. I want to section it vertically from top to bottom to avoid lacerating the crumb structure. And when I open it up, just opening it once I've sliced it down the middle, that's the telling moment, the exalting moment, or the disappointing moment, because I plunge my nose right in and I want to be assailed gently with an extraordinary bouquet of aromas.
Can I say something? This is all starting to sound pretty sexy.
Well, it is. But you know, baking bread is a sexual act.
I agree.
The baker mounts, in the French language, he mounts his kneading trough and he seeds. It's an act where in which you create life every day. So in some sense, the baking as well as the tasting have a profound sexual dimension. And we should feel good about that because it's fun and it gives us an idea of the kinds of things we're talking about. And once we've sectioned the bread and we've examined the aroma, we want to move back and take a look at the structure of the crumb. We want to see an extraordinary distribution of uneven little holes or cavities throughout the crumb. We want the crumb to be off-white. We want it to either be going towards gray or even towards yellow. We don't want a white bread that's oxidized. We want to see we want to have a springy crumb. We want it to have a certain kind of moist sensuality. We want it to be round in our hands and in our mouth. We don't want anorexic breads which lack flesh.
We need to talk about the crust, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean that's the heart of it.
Precisely. The definition of a French baguette is above all a crusty baguette, and if there's no crust, if the crust has become limp, If the crust has disappeared, it's just not good quality.
Again, sexual. Everything is sexual with you. You have a problem, monsieur.
I'm in France, and there are certain obligations that we have to adhere to here.
Does it bother the French that you're judging their bread?
It worried me initially, and it caused me to use a mixture of humor and a certain kind of self-derision. But now I think when they talk about me in crude terms, they call me the Robert Parker of bread. I'm not sure I like that for all sorts of reasons, even though it's meant to be flattery. And now I think I'm accepted as being a major voice in determining what's good and what's bad. This is not the bread police, you know.
Mm, right.
It's not, but it's like a film critic, it's like a literary critic, it's like a food critic. We don't pretend that taste is not ultimately a subjective experience, but we try to provide a kind of range of vocabulary of a kind of normalized sort, a kind of grill of reading, so that we can talk to each other. If we have common criteria, if we have categories that are at once coherent but relatively flexible, then we can have a conversation.
That's
what I do. I try and create this, and I don't pronounce from on high, this is great, this is terrible. I try and be nuanced, and I try and talk about what my nose and what my mouth tell me.
I was reading actually about a French in a New York Times article about you, a French restaurateur who respected what you were doing and respected all of the things you do. And when asked about your nationality, he said it was, well, a bit of a pity.
I got to tell you something. Nobody does condescending like the French. I tell you, that's great. I mean, they got that all wrapped up with
that. So that's true, and I can't. I can't say much except that it is probably nothing short of amazing that I have been accepted by the French in this regard. And it's not because I passed my time deprecating Americans, although I tend to be as much as I can symmetrically critical of everything I experience on both sides of the ocean.
So up at Cornell, they must refer to you as Professor Auntie Atkins.
Our guest today has been Stephen Kaplan. We've been talking about bread. Professor Kaplan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us on the show.
A pleasure.
Thanks so much,
super.
Professor.
You can find out more about Stephen Kaplan and what he writes about bread on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we suggest you go there early and often, and we're going to go have a little bread with our lunch today.
Sounds
I think
great.
It's really incumbent upon us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi Restaurant. Today we talked a lot about bread. We had the world's preeminent bread scholars, Stephen Kaplan, who we spoke to from his home in France.
You know that the French are angry with him for being the preeminent scholar on bread.
And he's an American? I kind of like it.
He's written 14 books on bread.
He's been given the Legion of Honor twice for his work on bread.
Yeah.
He's a little nutty.
He's
in a good kind of bready kind of way.
In a scholarly kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so when we talk about bread, when Mark and I opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, now we worked for years and we opened Stage Left to find the right bread. And what we wound up doing was we wound up after about 2 years of starting with good bread and winding up with what is hopefully great bread. We have a bakery up in North Jersey. Contract baked the bread to our specifications for us. But they couldn't... So it was two kinds of bread that we carry at the restaurant, and sometimes a third for rolls for our amazing hamburgers. But for the Italian restaurant, we needed a very different kind of bread, and this one bakery just couldn't do it.
It was a French baker, and he just couldn't... The Italian breads just weren't happening.
And so now we actually have two restaurants in the same building. We buy bread from
two different
places. And, you know, people say, why don't you make your own bread? I've been to a lot of places to bake their own bread, and it's not as good. We don't have the expertise. Even with two restaurants and 250 seats, and we use a lot of bread.
It is the only thing we buy.
We spend a lot of money on bread, but we worked with two companies, and we looked. Mark, we must have tasted, it was months we were searching for the right Italian bread that could be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys would deliver bread, but if it got humid one day, their bread wasn't as good.
Well, I'll just tell a quick story.
It's the mark of a great restaurant.
We picked a bread company in the very beginning of opening Catherine Lombardi, and we tasted the bread. Spectacular. Okay? Bread came day one, very good. Day two, very good. We get to about the second week, all of a sudden the bread is kind of soggy. The bread is not right. It's not the bread that we had originally looked at. Well, we investigate, call the company. No, we haven't changed any bakers. No, we haven't changed any tactics. We do everything exactly the same. Anyway, so we go back and forth a few times. We're like, listen, we're going to have to stop using you. We just can't. The bread, while it tastes very good, tactily is not what we want. We want a crispy outside, a little crunch to it, a little snap. And we couldn't get this bread. Anyway, within a couple of days of that conversation, where Francis and I are deciding exactly which bakery we're going to go with, I walk into the restaurant. I see the bread has been delivered. And I see that now the bread is delivered in paper bags. Well, now it also has a plastic sleeve on the inside, and the bread is tied into the plastic sleeve.
So the warm bread isn't breathing
anymore.
It's
tied into a knot. And you have warm bread in there, and what's actually on the inside of this bag is condensate. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this condensate is sogging out the inside of this because the warm bread has to be in an open air.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in open air, and we're not picking up the bread for 2 or 3 hours after they're delivering the bread, and it can't be in this plastic baggie.
And we solved the problem.
But
restaurant detectives.
Any small little thing
can totally
affect what happens to your bread. And that's one of the things I think that Professor Kaplan was talking about. And again, I want to reiterate, that's not Steve Kaplan who has the show immediately after ours. This is a professor at Ithaca College, Steve Kaplan, who also has a residence in Paris.
Now, the other thing about bread that is interesting is we used a number of bakers when we started Stage Left who made good bread in the wintertime, but they couldn't make good bread in the summertime. Because bread is a very temperamental thing. It altitude makes a difference in
very
rising.
Much so.
And in the summertime, when things get more humid, you need to take extra care that the balance of the bread is just perfect. It's really a crazy, crazy science.
And he talked about those four ingredients, yeast, which is living and breathing and changes and is different depending on what strain of yeast you're using. It's going to make the bread very different. Salt content of the bread is very important. Flour, the type of flour that you use is obviously going to make a very different kind of bread. And the ingredient that Francis and I talk about all the time that I think is the most overlooked ingredient in cooking is the water.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why are the bagels different in Manhattan than they are in Las Vegas or in Los Angeles? It's the water. Why is the pasta different in Italy than it is in the United States?
Water.
The water.
I'll tell you, it's funny. One of the things that we didn't get to talk about with Professor Kaplan was he doesn't have a problem with bread machines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, if you have a bread that you make in a bread machine at home, it is not as good as the fresh-made bread made by a really good bread baker. It's just not, and it will be more uniform.
But it's a million times better
than supermarket bread.
Than Wonder or even Pepperidge Farm or even some of the okay mass-produced bread.
And freshness matters when it comes to bread. So having an okay bread made in your bread machine at home, it's fun. I think those things are great, and they're very easy to use.
Yeah,
I will tell you the one thing that makes me sad. I don't know if you know this. I think I work late more than Mark, and Mark may come in early more than I do because, he has that whole family thing going on. So often on nights when I put in too many hours, I'm leaving at 4 in the morning, and I rarely anymore leave when the sun is coming up. But the little mark of sadness for me is if the bread is being delivered as I'm walking out. Hey, Marty. Hey, Francis. Here's the bread. Good night.
Thanks
you
very
just
much.
Going home? Yeah. My drone's almost done. Very, very disappointing, something I try seriously to do.
Think I'll have a piece of bread before I go to bed.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Funny bread story I got for you. We talked today with the world's preeminent expert on bread. Find out more about him at our website.
There's lots of funny bread out there.
I'm thinking more funny your brother. and in the pitfalls of learning another language, as we discussed with Professor Kaplan, the French do hubris really well. I don't know if they do bread and hubris really well. Condescending, I think, is what we said they do really well. I remember two things. I remember one is my friend Thierry Bruno, and I can use his last name. He's not going to come back from France and be mad at me. Actually, he'd be proud. And Thierry was a real bon vivant. He was a sommelier in New York. And he had this accent like this. And I'm like, Terry, you've been here for like 4 years. You don't lose the accent? I was like, no, the girls love the accent like this. And I remember he said, I'm going back to France. My family, they live in the Loire Valley, and I'm going back to France. I was like, France is great. He's like, France, beautiful country. You know the only problem with France? What's that, Terry? Full of freaking French people.
Very funny.
I have to go visit Terry in France. If you're listening over there in France, Terry, send me an email.
The story Francis was going to tell about my brother. When we were younger, my brother and I each spent a summer working in France. My father had a business concern there, and we both lived with a family in the countryside in France, and it was a great, great experience. They didn't speak any English. Very fun for us, and we got to learn a lot about speaking French.
And in the pitfalls of learning a foreign language.
Well, there's an expression in French, okay? And it's called laissez-moi ma basket, or leave me my sneakers, okay? And it means leave me alone, stop picking on me, get away from me. And my brother was feeling a little picked on one day, and he just missed it by just the tiniest little bit. And instead of saying laissez-moi mes baskets, he said laissez-moi mes baguettes. Okay, and the only difference with that expression and leaving my sneakers is it's Well, the expression my brother used was, lick my long French bread. And roar. The room roared when he tried to use that little colloquialism.
30 years later, they still mock him for that, don't they?
They do indeed. When my brother and I go back to France, they still say to him, Laissez-moi mes baguettes.
I would say,
idiot.
I would say that the one story from who Stephanie was her name, the daughter from the family who came here and stayed with you for a while. And then the first time I went to France, she's like, oh, come and visit me. I'll meet you on the train station in this little town. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to come and take like the train that arrives at 1 a.m. Uh-huh. and like be left at the train station in this town, like in a movie with like not a big town, like a little town, like a platform and the choo-choo pulls away and you're alone in the field. Didn't show up.
Yeah, she was probably having some wine.
I don't speak French. Hello. Hello. Bonjour.
Un taxi, s'il vous plaît.
Hate that. Hated that. Really hated that. A lot. Okay. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're going to go have some bread for lunch. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.